foot of the walls, orc bodies crushed beneath them. "Hang on! Drive them back!" Tandibur bellowed orders right and left. "It's easier than swatting flies! Don't let a single one pass!" He raised his axe and struck an orc between neck and collarbone. Dark green blood spurted skywards, and the orc fell back, pulling four of his kind with him to their deaths. Fighting was easier now that the monsters, in their terror, had stopped using crossbows and covering fire from their catapults. This meant that the dwarves could risk showing themselves between the battlement merlons and use cudgels on the orcs' broad, ugly heads as soon as they appeared. Then the black-armored attackers arrived. Shortly before the clash of the ranks, they opened their visors, and violet light streamed out. Tandibur heard the bone marrow-shaking noise of their hissing and growling, like an army of snakes and the thunder of a volcanic eruption. It warned of the danger and merciless bloodlust of these creatures before they tore through the orc mass like a sharp blade slicing rotten wood. They did not halt, but ran straight into the throng of monsters, each wielding two weapons. Crushed and mutilated, or split in half, orcs littered the ground at Silverfast. "By Rakus! What beasts are these?" The dwarves felt the hairs on their necks rise in horror. Tandibur now shared the orc's deadly fear. Instinctively, he hid behind the battlements. What reached him was the ineradicable memory of the appalling noises. Sharp screeches and bellows. Pain stopped abruptly mid-howl. A chorus of dying so terrible that it ate away even at the mind of a dwarf. Sigdal looked at Tandibur. "I have heard of a creature like this," he remembered. "It was the bodyguard of Andikai the Tempestuous, the Beggar. No one knew where it was from, but it was said to look like those things down there. They called it Jerun. It was the king of all monsters that Samusin and Teon ever created." "But you can't see anything inside the armor?" "No, it's that dazzling light." Signal pointed to the face. Tandibur shook himself. A third dwarf hurried up. "Shall I have the tower shoot at them, Tandibur?" he asked. "They make big targets we can't miss." Tandibur looked at Sigdal. "Andakai's bodyguard, you think?" "If the stories are true," said the dwarf, leaving a slight trace of doubt in the air. The noise of battle on the other side surged closer to the walls. Tandibur looked down. The black-plated beings had traversed the plain, cutting a bloody swathe through the orc army, now in disarray. It looked as if a wild animal had got into a chicken coop. The attackers had only lost a handful. The orcs were so panic-stricken that their only urge was flight. They stormed away in small groups toward the far edge of the plain. Just before they reached the outer lands, they were confronted by a new wall of black iron. Tandibur yelled, "Look at that! They've drawn the greenskins into a trap. They're butchering them. So, do we fire or not?" asked the dwarf once more. Tandibur shook his head. "Wait and see what they do next." Until the evening fell, they watched the unknown creatures harry and kill the orcs one by one. Then ogres and trolls fell to their superior strength. Night covered the narrow gorge that led to Girdlegard, and with the darkness came silence. There were no screams from the orcs. The dwarves heard no more groaning. Not a breath was left in the heap of bodies at the foot of Silverfast's high towers. The unknown beings wandered through the carnage, checking cadavers, and if anything twitched in the confusion of tangled limbs and heads, they followed through with a deadly blow from their blood-stained weapons. The stars hid themselves behind thick clouds, unwilling to view the results of the massacre. Soon the dwarves noticed the sound of scraping and scrabbling. "Any idea what they're up to?" asked Sigdal as he spied out at the scene. It is so devilishly dark that even with eyes like mine I can't see." Tandibur took a burning torch and tossed it down from the battlements. The faint light showed black-armored warriors moving about, dragging two or three orcs by the feet from the field of slaughter. "What will they do with them?" wondered Sigdal. Tandibur pointed. To the left, more of the strange beings were stripping the flesh from the bones of ogres and trolls. With great blows from their weapons, they shattered the bones so that the marrow could be sucked out. Victory was providing its own celebration banquet. "By Fracas!" mouthed Sigdal in horror. "The king of the monsters, eh?" said Tandibur, glad when the torch gave out, veiling these ghastly activities in darkness once more. "Then it seems we have here a whole folk of kings." He went to the steps. It was time to give Goldfast a full report of the action. "Get the gates repaired, and have more rocks brought up here to the walkways. These creatures must be kept under constant observation. They may have freed us from the threat of the orcs' attack, but we don't want them getting curious about the taste of dwarf flesh." Tired, and with aching limbs, he walked down the stairway. Then, escorting the walking wounded, he moved off along the basalt planking toward the second fortress. Tandibur was sensing they would have to confront whatever hid behind the black visors of these new warriors. "But with what weapons?" he whispered. "How can they be stopped?" He prayed to Vracus that this small army of giants at Silverfast would not concern themselves with the dwarfs. Not today, not tomorrow, not in 10,000 cycles. Girdlegard, Kingdom of Eidoslain, 10 miles from the caves of Toboribor. Late summer, 6,241st solar cycle. Lot Ionan sat quietly by the fire warming his hands. The nights had lost their summer mildness, and after his 6 petrified cycles, there was permanent cold within him. Neither hot tea, nor warm brandy, nor thick blankets could drive it out. Dergard was already asleep. Ireheart cut himself a piece of the rabbit from the spit roast. He chewed away, making unsatisfied noises.
"Magus, are you sure we can't get you those last few miles? It's not far now."
Lot Ionan raised his white head.
"Trust me, Boindil. I would rather sleep in a warm tent than in the open air."
He eased his back with his right hand.
"My back is too painful to get back in the saddle."
Ireheart was calculating what the old man might weigh.
"I could carry you."
Tungdil cut a morsel of meat for Circa. During the journey, he had spent hours thinking about Girdlegard's precarious situation. He had confided in Lot Ionan, but even with help from the Magus, no satisfactory course of action had emerged. Otherwise, he observed an iron silence. Not even Ireheart had been taken into their confidence. Since the incident on the farm, there was a split in a friendship that had withstood tests in the past. This time it seemed difficult to get over. Not speaking meant an uncomfortable atmosphere between the two of them.
"Leave it, Ireheart. Let the Magus get some rest. It's no good if he's thoroughly exhausted when we get there."
Circa took the slice of meat and placed it between pieces of bread. She tasted it gingerly. "Now I know what I love about my own land," she said, fighting down a mouthful. "The meat tastes better."
"Probably how they feed the animals," grinned Tungdil. "Well, I like it," mumbled Ireheart, making light work of the rest of the rabbit after Rodario had indicated he did not want any more.
The playwright was sitting next to Lot Ionan, scribbling away by candlelight.
"Say, Circa, could you tell us about where you're from?" he said suddenly, dipping his pen in the ink. "We can see you, we saw your soldiers, and we've heard about the adventures in Girdlegard."
The quill made circles in the air.
But what's it like back in... He paused expectantly.
Letifora? She completed. Why do you want to know?
To go in this play, and I'm curious.
Rodario laughed.
Exotica goes down well on stage. The punters love a whiff of the outer lands.
Circa's close-shaven head shimmered in the light, her dark skin enhancing the whiteness of her teeth.
Letifora is a city where many races live. Humans, Akronta, Ubariu, and ourselves. The buildings are finer than any in Girdlegard. Not even the dwarves can match us for our architecture.
She noted the indignation in Ironheart's face.
Don't look at me like that. I don't mean the dwarf buildings are not good. They are just...
She shrugged her shoulders.
Smaller. So what's the deal with monsters and things? Asked Rodario. Oh, I expect you'll find even their monsters are bigger than ours, and they probably fly. Their screams will deafen you, and a mere sight of one will strike you dead, scoffed Boindil.
He wiped the meat juices off his overshort beard.
Just like Jeroen.
Circa nodded.
You're right, Boindil.
Absolutely spot on, even if I don't know what a Jeroen is.
Our beasts are very varied. We have Fotor, winged orcs, and enough other creatures to make the bravest warriors quail and take flight. Only human soldiers, I'd wager.
Goda joined in, earning a grateful look from her tutor.
Or elves, perhaps, but never the children of the smith.
Before the harmless storytelling could develop into a fully-fledged row about the dwarves and their courage, Tungdil threw in a question. So far, he had listened with great interest, hanging on every word from Circa's dark lips.
When we were travelling north, through to the outer lands, we found this rune on the wall.
He sketched a shape in the sand.
Circa reflected and drew a clearer version next to it. It must have been this one. It's an ancient sign that indicates a safe mountain pass. Long ago our people reconnoitred the whole of the northern range. Ah, said Ironheart, pointing at her with the end of a rabbit bone he had been chewing at.
So you were preparing to attack Girdlegard?
Yes, said Circa. But when we learned that dwarves were manning the gates, we gave up. We assumed the land behind the gates would be in your hands.
She said all this in a tone of voice that could have been lies or truth. Nobody could work it out.
Very enlightening, said Rodario, and went on writing. In view of the situation, I'll be circumspect on the matter of invading Girdlegard.
He put on a serious face. The audience might not like it. We can do without upsetting people right now.
That's if it's true,
said Goda, taking firm hold of her night star to sharpen the blades with a whetstone.
Sounded to me like she was having us on.
Circa grinned.
Who knows? Perhaps our scouts are still out there, waiting for their opportunity.
Oh, a sense of humour. Do you know the one about the orc asking a dwarf the way?
Boindil was starting to warm up.
Hang on!
Tungdil had just remembered the young dwarf that had never returned. When Circa mentioned the undergroundling scouts, an explanation occurred to him for the disappearance. He put the subject to her.
Yes, I met one, came the reply. What?
Ironheart tossed the bone back over his shoulder.
What were you doing with the clan dwarf? I thought he was a thirdling that had run off.
A thirdling? No.
Circa asked for the water bottle to rinse the last taste of rabbit away. He had been following our scouts and got lost. It was too late when we found him. He was thin as a rake, talking rubbish about machines and saying he wanted to protect Girdlegard from them. He died of exhaustion soon after.
Tungdil nodded.
They had done the right thing telling Gremdalin Ironbite's mother her son had died. They had not wanted to awaken false hopes.
What were your scouts looking for at the gateway? seeing what was new.
Serka placed the log on the fire, seeing if things were all right. They heard the sound of approaching hoofbeats. A lantern swayed a couple of feet above the ground, illuminating the path for horse and rider.
A messenger from Prince Malin, guessed Rodario, getting up. Good. He can tell the army we'll be with them tomorrow.
The dwarves got to their feet as well, ready for a fight. The rider saw the campfire and came over.
The blessings of Rekkus on you, came the greeting. Good things come in threes. Bramdel,
Iahert cursed under his breath. Now it's certain. He's spying on us, he whispered to Tongdil. It's no coincidence we keep bumping into him.
The executioner rode up and dismounted, using his patent rope ladder.
There was far too good a smell of meat. I couldn't simply ride past.
Iahert gleefully held up the rabbit carcass he had gnawed clean.
Too late, executioner. Death was way ahead of you this time. On your way.
Bramdel's dark clothing made it difficult to see where he ended and the darkness began. It helped that he had light blonde beard braids and a pale face.
Looks like there's not much warmth at this fireside. What's the matter? You need to ask.
Iahert took a step forward, and Goda did the same.
You turn up out of the blue once too often. Your business is with death, and then to cap it all, you sell off the dead bodies. What decent dwarf would do that?
Bramdel wedged his thumbs under his belt.
I don't work as an executioner now, Boindel Doubleblade. I told you before. And the fact we keep meeting is due to the fact that we are both heading the same way. Why should I want to keep bumping into you? My friend thinks you spy for the dwarf haters.
Tungdil watched the other's face very carefully.
Then wouldn't I have my weapons drawn and be attacking you?
Bramdel sat down on the grass.
I could just stay quiet and pretend I don't mind being accused like that. Later on, when you're all asleep, I could slit your throats and rob Girdlegard of its greatest heroes.
He looked at Lotionen.
Did I forget something? You forgot to mount up and ride off again, suggested Iahert. Be off with you, hangman. We don't want you here. What if I were bringing Trovegold news to the army?
Tungdil moved over next to him.
If you like, give us your news, and then be on your way. If you don't want to share it, then mount up and ride off now.
He wanted to be rid of the executioner because he feared Boindil was going to lose his temper. Bramdel made a regretful face.
So that's the thanks I get for helping you reach the Freelings that time? You drive me away from your fireside? No.
Iahert drew himself up in front of the executioner, his warhammer in his hands.
It's me who's chasing you off.
Bramdel sighed.
I should have known you wouldn't be friendly. I got that impression last time we met.
He stood up and went to his horse.
Trovegold is sending Prince Malin money toward the expense of the siege. In return for that, the Freelings want to trade in Eidoslane, and have asked to negotiate with their largest towns.
He climbed up onto his specially adapted saddle.
I would say there is a new alliance on its way there.
From high up on his mount, Bramdel nodded down at the others.
Because you never know how long the old ones will hold.
He cantered off toward the southeast. For a long time they could still see his lantern. Then he crested the brow of a hill and disappeared from view.
Good riddance.
Iahert sat down again. He pulled a second rabbit out from behind a rock and skinned it. One puny little rabbit was never going to have been enough for him.
What does all that mean?
Rodario asked himself, and then the rest of them.
Are the Freelings afraid the dwarf peoples will change their minds?
It looks like it.
Lotionen looked at Tungdil.
Can there be a reason?
No. I never saw anything in the talks to indicate a worsening of relationships. I don't know why they're looking for support like this.
Tungdil threw himself down on the grass. Serka joined him.
Do they know more than us?
We'll find out tomorrow.
Lot Ionan shivered and put more wood on the fire.
Let's not waste time worrying about it now. There are more important things. Let's get some sleep.
Goda was given first watch, and the others bedded down by the fire. Tungdil thought for a long time about what the executioner had said. Girdlegard, Kingdom of Eidoslain, 4 miles from the Toboribor Caves, late summer, 6241st solar cycle. Tungdil and his companions halted on a small hill and surveyed the biggest siege ever mounted in Girdlegard. The scene was impressive. The joint armies of the Girdlegard kingdoms and the Elf realm encircled the entrance to the Orcs' underground domain. Nothing and no one could escape unseen. No less than 70,000 warriors and volunteers had gathered here to confront the evil, in the shape of the Unslayables and their ghastly machine hybrids. The deep green of field and orchard was marred by a black line of trenches. Immediately behind lay the army encampments of the various kingdoms. Small, portable bridges were available as need arose to cross the trenches. The dwarves' numerous tents were pitched well behind the boundary. From there, units would set off to rage through the caves of Toboribor in search of the Unslayables, one of the sentries told Tungdil's group. Nearly all the clans of the dwarf tribes had sent troops. A sea of standards and banners fluttered in the warm breeze, and, a little way off, the flags of the Freelings were flying.
"Isn't that splendid? The evil won't get through that lot."
Ironheart surveyed the scene proudly.
"That's if the evil is in the caves in the first place."
There was doubt in Lot Ionan's voice. Tungdil nodded.
"Let's find out how successful they've been so far in eradicating the Unslayable danger for all time."
He spurred his pony on. The Freelings had their camp set up too far away from the dwarves for his liking. Bramdil was proving to be correct. Lot Ionan rode next to him.
"Have you got any further with your cogitations, or are you still as much in the dark as I am?"
"I am lost as well," he sighed. "It all stands or falls with how the elves behave. I won't risk a guess."
He forced his gaze away from the banners of the town.
"I don't want to guess either. Estelin didn't seem the type to be telling lies, though there must be other reasons for elves to fire on elves. At any event, it was better that we left him in the village back there. I want to make up my own mind."
The Magus indicated the tent bearing Malin's standard.
"Let's ride over. I think we should tell him everything. From what you say, he is a level-headed ruler, even if he is an Eido."
Bramdil must have given warning of their approach. They were received with shouted greetings and much approving pounding of fists on shields from the soldiers. Men bowed respectfully to the Magus, delighted to see him returned. The unusual noise drew Malin out of his tent. He was attired in the impressive suit of armor his ancestors had worn, and his fair hair streamed free.
"Welcome to Eidoslain, noble Lot Ionan," the prince bowed. "And welcome to you all."
He shook hands with Rodario and Ironheart.
"Master Bramdil told us you would be joining us soon. The greatest heroes are now assembled. We will meet the Unslayables head on."
Holding the tent flap open, the ruler invited them inside.
"If you are not too tired, I'd like to explain what we've achieved in the past few orbits."
He sent messengers out to summon the dwarf commanders. Then he addressed Lot Ionan.
"You will forgive us for not putting on an adequate celebration in honor of your return, but we have no time to lose."
The Magus nodded.
"But of course, Prince Malin. There are more important matters.
Celebrations can wait until our victory.
Like all the others, he noticed the peculiar painting on the inside of the tent walls.
A map, Malon explained. This is the dwarfs' work. They have surveyed and drawn out all the caves they have penetrated here.
He pointed to the blue shaded area. These parts they have taken over already. They have set up small strongholds within the cave complex.
But are the unslayables really in the caves? The Magus wanted to know, seating himself at the table.
The others followed suit.
We're certainly working on that assumption. The dwarves have had sight of all their monsters. I think they're supposed to be diverting our attention from the unslayables themselves. That's why the dwarves are fighting their way into the sections where resistance initially was low.
Malon showed them the part he was referring to, marked in green.
They were right. Suddenly fierce resistance was encountered, and it looks as if the last of the Alphar are holed up in this cave area.
Gundagar strode in, and Tungdil and the other Girdlegard dwarves bowed respectfully in greeting. A little way behind came the Freeling commanders, and Bramdil. He gave them an inscrutable smile.
"What a pleasure to see all of you safe and well!"
Gundagar exclaimed. "And you, Magus, I have only known as a stone statue, so you must be Lotionan the Forbearing."
Not all escaped with their lives. Far too many were carried off to Vrakis's eternal smithy,
Tungdil interjected, giving a concise report of what had occurred in Weyen.
"We lost Fergus on the island. He burned to death in molten iron. We saw it happen, and could do nothing to save him."
Malon and the High King both felt silent at this news.
"So, Fergus is dead."
Malon leaned forward on the table.
"We shall miss his genius. In the past he wrought good as well as bad. I don't want to sound heartless, but did he at least say where his machine creature's weak points might lie?"
"Yes."
Rodario, eyes glistening at the thought of his dear friend, took out a folder he had carried in his saddlebag and put it on the table.
"He left me several drawings to show where each monster will be most vulnerable."
He cleared his throat, choked with emotion.
"The points in question are small. Steady hands and a true aim will be needed when they are attacked."
Passing the folder of drawings to a servant to have copies made, Malon said,
"Trust me, I regret his death, but now is not the time to mourn the passing of friends. It will have to wait until the Alphar have been defeated."
The tent opened again to admit Rajaelin. She brought an escort of three guards and two unarmed elves.
"No one told me that a meeting had been arranged," she said with a gracious smile. "If I hadn't seen Gundagar entering the tent, I would have missed it. Did you not wish to hear the view of the elves?"
Iarhart opened his mouth.
"You can be. Boindil was about to say that you can be sure we would have called you,"
Tungdil interrupted smartly, "because we need your warriors as soon as possible into Boribor, and not in the dwarf realms any more."
"Why is that? Surely you need us to keep the gateways safe while so much of your fighting force is here into Boribor.
The monsters still present an undeniable threat.
The monsters and the undercover thirdlings in your own ranks."
However charming and considerate her tone of voice, criticism was clear in Rajaelin's message. It was her opinion that the thirdling traitors should have been assiduously sought out. Tungdil was not surprised by what she said. Not any more. She was walking the paths of the Eoil.
"We have received information that the caves have a connection to the outer lands. Under the very feet of the besieging army, a new horde is waiting. The dwarves in the caves are good warriors, but even they and the army of humans would not be able to withstand this horde without the elves."
He knew that she would fall for this lie. She would not be able to help herself, even if she had seen it coming.
"Where do you get this knowledge from, Tungdil Goldhand?"
she asked in surprise.
"The thirdlings we captured told us.
and he related the Wayan adventures in an adapted version without mentioning the role Fergus had probably played. He left it with the Thirdlings and Unslayables being the evil doers.
Bandilor had made common cause with the Alfar. He told us the Unslayables' plans. They suited his own intentions.
The elf princess looked at him searchingly.
And you believe the word of a dwarf who allied himself with the evil?
I trust words spoken in fear of death, Tungdil corrected. He thought that I would spare him, and Lot Ionan tested the truth of his words with magic.
Tungdil looked at the others with silent pleading in his expression. He received support from an unexpected quarter.
We shall be needing Alandor's elf warriors here, Your Highness. Right now, before the enemy hordes spill out and swamp us. Do you want to carry the responsibility of Ida Slain and the whole of Girdlegard fall under their sway?
It was more a demand than a request that Prince Malin was putting to Rejalin. Two issues coincided. It was his own land that was threatened, and he was starting to like the elf woman less and less. And though it might not be wise to speak boldly, he did not hold back.
Tungdil was relieved. It made his own lie sound more credible. Now you are demanding my support, Prince Malin?
Rejalin lifted her cup of water and sipped long and slow.
Did you not recently expel my envoys from your court?
There is a difference between a delegation and an army, Princess, he said. It was not in my mind to hold intellectually sophisticated conversations at a time when I am concerned with protecting our homeland from new and potentially disastrous threats.
He leaned forward.
As soon as we have won, I shall be delighted to receive your delegates for a cultural exchange. But until then, please understand that I cannot accept your offers. Instead, please send an army. That I shall welcome with open arms.
Gandagar nodded.
Don't worry, Rejalin. We are aware of the value of your assistance, but we can defend ourselves well enough. And to reassure you further, we have already identified and imprisoned 7 dwarf haters who had been living undercover amongst us. We found them without the use of torture, he added. The Thirdlings, who are intent on becoming assimilated, helped us with this.
There was no way out for the elf princess.
Then let it be so, she decided, smiling away her defeat. Messengers shall leave today to bring my warriors to Toboribor.
She studied the cave map.
The dwarves should move more quickly. The more we know about the tunnels and chambers underground, the better prepared we shall be to meet the hordes from the outer lands. It will be useful to be able to lay traps and ambushes.
I agree with you.
Gandagar raised his tankard and drank to her health.
The miners shall find the best places to set traps and start work at once.
Do we know anything about when this new army might appear? Asked Rejalin. Perhaps my forces will be too late.
No. Bandilor spoke of preparations. We still have time in hand, he reassured her. Forgive me, but my friends and I are tired from the journey. We can hold an official meeting tomorrow to inform the other commanders. Now I would like to rest.
The elf princess concurred and withdrew, followed by the town commanders and Bramdel. Hardly had they left than Tungdil arranged with Gandagar and Malin to hold a secret meeting outside the camp at nightfall.
No guards, no retinue. Just you two, he insisted before he went. Trust me. It is important, so tell no one.
Surprised by the urgency of his appeal, the leaders agreed. As the stars started to appear over Eiderslane, the three of them met at the appointed place. Malin and Gandagar were both intrigued, but Tungdil asked them to be patient, and he then stayed silent. Lot Ionan soon joined them, and the four of them rode off to the Dieseldorf Inn, where they had left Estalan. Tungdil thought the elf was looking even more handsome since recovering from his fever. Better, He seemed fresher, more dazzling than any other living being in the vicinity. Just like Rajalin. Gandagar and Malin were sitting in the empty parlour of the inn, listening to the elf's story by candlelight, their faces grave.
"Then I was right to distrust them," said the prince. "Even if I would have preferred to be convinced of the goodness of the elves instead of hearing this news. It is appalling that they killed their leader." Gandagar could not credit it. "And because I think the elf warriors are capable of anything, I invented a subterfuge to recall them to Taboribor," said Tungdil. "I prefer to have them all in one place, where we have our armies, rather than strewn throughout Girdlegard where they could do untold damage." "You spoke of magic." Malin raised his eyes and looked at Lot Ionan. "Do you know anything about elf magic, noble Magus?" "Not really. The elves, just like their dark cousins the elf are capable of casting minor spells in connection with their way of life. According to my old books, these are mostly to do with the realm of flowers and decorative arts. Lutacil never mentioned his folk having the power to use magic in the same way as a Magus or a Maga."
"That may only be partly so," Estelin chimed in. His voice sounded impossibly pure to human ears. "The elves of Alandor were never reputed to be very interested in magic. But others of my people, the elves of the Golden Plain, who were persecuted by the Alfar, were more open to such arts. I remember hearing that the small number of Golden Plain elves that survived the Alfar ravages fled to us in Alandor." Tungdil noticed that the elf's speech was changing, becoming more flowery and, to his ears, unbearable.
"That makes things different. So we cannot exclude the possibility of there being a descendant of these magically endowed elves in the ranks of the Aetar. Perhaps the Eoil gave him part of their knowledge."
Lot Ionan was summarizing.
"That explains why they want the diamond."
Gandagar furrowed his brow.
"Please, don't think I am being unreasonable, noble Magus. But what if you or Durgard had the power of the stone? How powerful would that make you?" "If it is as Tungdil tells me, then this power would be..."
He rubbed his white beard as he searched for the right word.
"Immeasurable," he said finally. "The power would be immeasurable."
He laughed slyly.
"Have no fear, High King Gandagar. It does not entice me, and for Durgard it is the same. We have the magic source to give us the same power. It would be nothing special for us, and then of course neither Durgard nor I are attracted to evil."
"Are you so sure?"
Gandagar disappeared behind the bar and poured them all some simple country wine.
"He was one of Nudin's pupils. We know what happened to that Magus.
But don't forget the particular circumstances, Your Majesty," Lot Ionan said, taking young Durgard's part. "There is no demon sending out insidious messages. Our opponents are mighty, but they are physical enemies, and thus we can confront them."
He held out his hand to receive the crockery mug, but gasped with pain. His back was troubling him with the movement. His eyes glazed and grew dim. Then he thought he saw a figure by the door, a strangely familiar figure.
"Nudin?
Noble Lot Ionan. What is it?" The bearded face of Tungdil appeared suddenly in his field of vision, looking very worried.
"Is it your back again?"
The Magus shook his head, emptied the mug of wine and asked for more.
"There are probably still tiny fragments of stone embedded in my body," he said slowly. "They affect my mind and make me see things that cannot be there."
He stood up and went over into the dark corner of the room where he had seen his old friend. But however hard he looked, to his great relief, he could find no trace.
"What is the matter, noble Magus?"
"Nothing. I must stretch my legs. My back
It hurts. I never noticed when I was a statue.
He returned to the group.
So what shall we do with the elves?
He picked up the thread again. He was cold now.
Shall we confront them and hear what they have to say? Or shall we deal with the unslayables first?
My feeling is we should not postpone the conflict with the princess, said Malin. I'll tell you why. I don't like the idea of the elves following their own ends in the middle of a battle with the Alfar and their new creatures, snatching the diamond for themselves and then carrying out unimaginable deeds with its power. Of course they will defeat the evil, I have no doubt.
His gaze took in all of them.
But I don't think they will let us influence their decisions after that. I want to have Regalin as a hostage before the battle starts.
A good plan, if the elves go along with it, said Lot Ionan, rubbing his eyes as if to punish his sight for the trick it had played on him. Now, Prince Malin has just said exactly what I was thinking. If they refuse, it will be obvious they're up to no good, said Estelin, raking his fine hair with his fingers. I would suggest taking no risks at all. Let's impound all the elf warriors from Alandur. There aren't many of them here at Toboribor.
We'll take Estelin with us, and he can address the assembly in the morning, proposed Tungdil. And then we'll see what elves say in response to your story. Don't forget, we're all willing to listen to Estelin, because we have already had experience of the Aetar.
Malin turned to the elf.
But tomorrow, you'll be addressing a less compliant audience. King Nait from Tabain and Queen Issica are both strong contenders for the elf support camp. You may not win them round.
Estelin bent his head graciously, as if he were a monarch acceding to a request.
Thank you for your warning, Prince Malin. But I am sure I shall open the human's eyes, though it cost me my life.
Your life?
Echoed Gandagar in horror.
No, no, we do not wish that. We cannot lose the only right-thinking elf in the whole of Alandur.
It can't be helped. Estelin was adamant.
I know Regalin, and can predict how she will react. I shall provoke her, and from a certain point in my speech, the line will have been crossed.
He laid his hand on Tungdil's arm. This I owe to you, and to Gerdlegard. My life was preserved by Sitalia when she sent a dwarf to me. I understand the will of the goddess. Our two peoples must proceed together against those who could bring about the destruction of the elves.
Fracas looks kindly on what is happening in this room,
Gandagar spoke with emotion. His brown eyes encompassed the small group of conspirators.
Yet we should not forget to pray for the success of our venture. We urgently need the support of the gods.
He planted his hand on the center of the table, and Estelin laid his own hand on top.
Malin, Tongdil, and Lot Ionan followed suit.
May we meet with success,
the Magus said gravely. Gerdlegard, Kingdom of Eidoslain, 4 miles from the caves of Toboribor. Late summer 6241st solar cycle. Tungdil slept badly. He dreamed about Belindis and Circa. In the morning he awoke with only confused fragments still in his mind. Had the women been fighting about him? Or had he been fighting the women? Circa had plunged her knife in his heart. He sat up as soon as the first birds were singing. He felt his breast, where the pain had brought his dream to life.
A real nightmare, he sighed,
rubbing the sore place while he got to his feet. He washed and put on his clothes and armor. The face in the polished silver mirror was old and tired. Of course, this could all be the effect of the old drinking bouts, or of the frustration in his soul. It had not left him.
Have I done the right thing?
He asked his reflection, as so often in the past.
"Are you sleepwalking? Or did you really get up this early?"
said Ironheart, propping himself up on one elbow.
"What's the trouble? Birds too loud?"
Tungdil turned round to face him. "Get up, Boindil. I've got something to tell you." And so while he dressed, the warrior received a summary of the previous night's events.
"The assembly will be deciding today, and I want you to keep an eye on Estalin. Keep him safe from the elves. Protect him, not me."
Ironheart ran his hands through his black hair. It was still too short to braid.
"Why didn't you take me along to your meeting?"
he asked disappointedly.
"How have I forfeited your trust?"
Tungdil was surprised.
"I didn't think to, because..."
He was searching for a reason and could not find one at first. Well, not one he could actually voice. Boindil was drawing his own conclusions.
"It's Goda, isn't it?"
He pulled on his boots.
"You don't trust her, and you think I'll tell her everything. You think she's a spy for the dwarf haters. Since our quarrel at the farm, things haven't been right. It's not how we were at the beginning of this adventure, scholar. I keep wondering which of us has changed. How did it happen?"
"We have both changed, Ironheart." Tungdil hooked a stool with his foot and sat down by his friend.
"You've lost your heart to a dwarf we don't know. She could be up to anything. You don't see the danger, and I'm probably overreacting."
He smiled sadly.
"And my heart is lost to a dwarf you absolutely abhor." "Then it's the fault of the women, not us," the warrior grinned. "It's always the women."
Tungdil laughed quietly.
"That's being too simplistic."
He searched for the right words.
"I'm not happy, Boindil. Frustrated. In Girdlegard, there's nowhere I feel at home. I don't belong with the humans, I don't belong with the dwarves." "You'll be off to join the undergroundlings, then. I knew it."
"How?"
"You're the learned scholar, Tungdil. You sat around on your ass more than 5 cycles in Lot Ionan's vaults, trying to be a decent, settled dwarf, for the sake of Belindis. But your heart and soul weren't in it."
This took Tungdil by surprise. It was all true. He stared at his friend.
"Now, with the Unslayables, there's a new challenge for you. And then you'll be off over the hills and far away."
Ironheart smiled.
"Whatever kind of dwarf you are, Tungdil, you're not the type that likes settling down. There are a few more characteristics of the Children of the Smith that have passed you by as well. Good thing, too. You got the dwarfs and freelings together. You united the dwarf tribes, and Girdlegard has you to thank that it still exists in its present form."
He patted Tungdil on the knee and stood up.
"An ordinary dwarf like myself would never have managed all that. Vrakus made you like this to bring a bit of life into the race. Stay the way you are, scholar. I'll have to get used to it, even if it takes some time. You'll have to excuse my grumbling. I am, and remain, your friend."
He held out his hand.
"If you want my friendship." "How would I cope without a bad-tempered, honest dwarf?"
Tungdil grasped his hand and they embraced. He was glad they had had this exchange. The black curtains between them were now swept away. Ironheart beamed with relief.
"Now we've sorted that out, let's see how Pointy Ears deals with Estalin's accusations."
He shouldered the crow's beak.
"I said Pointy Ears on purpose, because she's not one of the elves we have to get on with."
He went over to where a canvas partition shielded Goda's sleeping quarters.
"Oh, it's great to be able to say Pointy Ears again."
Tungdil got himself a hearty breakfast. He sat quietly eating while Boindil was briefing his trainee for the assembly session. It did not escape her notice that her mentor kept taking a sideways glance over to Tungdil. Finally, she came over.
"What can I do to convince you
I am to be trusted. Give me a task. Exact an oath from me. Something to reassure you. I have Eilhart's confidence.
It's not necessary, Goda, Tungdil replied.
I want to get rid of these doubts you have about me, she insisted. We are both of the Thirdling tribe. You know what it is like not to be trusted.
He stayed silent about his and Gandagar's vague misgivings about letting the Thirdlings reassemble as a tribe in their own right.
Yes, I do. The memory of the rejection he had met with from Belindis's clan flashed through his mind. And I don't like having you so near me and Eilhart, Goda, when I have these doubts. But I have a duty to be cautious. If you were a spy for the dwarf-haters, you could cause immense damage with what you might learn.
She glared at him.
So, your doubts can't be removed?
Looking at Boindil, Tungdil said,
You have convinced my friend, Goda. Give me time. Maybe I can come to the same conclusion.
Not everyone is like Mir.
Her words shot out. Tungdil was shocked.
No, they are not all like her, he agreed softly, standing up and leaving the tent.
Outside in the light of the rising sun, he marched sharply off, up and down the hillocks, until he found the highest. Here he sat down on the dew-fresh grass, out of breath now. He surveyed the scene spread out before him. Smoke rose from a campfire or two. The army was starting to wake up, like the rest of Girdlegard. Perhaps Belindis, back in the Grey Range, was also waking. Was she looking at Glaimbar and thinking of him? Was she cursing his memory? Did she still love him, but understand it could lead nowhere? He hoped that she understood. Tungdil snatched up a few blades of grass. What was going to happen to Sirka and him? Would he only disappoint her, too? Turning these thoughts over in his mind, he remained on the hilltop until the sun climbed above the horizon. A fanfare signaled a meeting. He would arrive late, but no matter. They would not start without him.
Rakus, guide me, he begged,
getting to his feet, brushing the dew from his leather breeches, and relishing the feel of the cool dawn air on his face. He could not have said why he did so, but he turned toward the north. There he saw, 10 miles away, the wide snake heading toward them over the hills of Eiderslain. An army of considerable size was marching to Toboribor.
The Ubariu!
The thought shot through him. Without the Fourthlings having noticed, Sundalan had accompanied the army through the mountains to support his claim for the diamond. Tungdil tried to guess how many soldiers were involved. When Sirka had mentioned the number 80,000, she had not been lying. Now they had to hurry. He started back down immediately. The meeting was going to be really interesting now. He wondered how Regalian would react to the news of the approaching Ubariu. Secretly, Tungdil felt relieved to see the army. The elves would not dare to set out against such superior numbers. Gandagar would be shaken to hear that the dwarves were not in sole charge of Girdlegard's safety, and had not been for several thousand cycles.
Yes, this is going to be lively, he said to himself as he got near to the camp.
Sentries from the outposts were dashing in to inform Malin of the approach of what they took to be an orc army that had appeared out of nowhere. Tungdil went swiftly in, cutting a messenger off in mid-flow.
Your Highness, the approaching force is not an enemy, he explained. These people have kept Girdlegard safe in the past, just as my own have done. I shall send Sirka out to them. She will return to us with a delegation of the Ubariu.
Prince Malin, surrounded by tumult, tried to think.
I have stopped being surprised by anything, he said flatly. Let us meet in the conference marquee.
Tungdil bowed and went off to give Sirka her instructions. Girdlegard, Kingdom of Eiderslain,
4 miles from the caves of Taboribor. Late summer, 6241st solar cycle. The besieging armies were in complete uproar. 400 Ubariu standards had appeared on the hills behind the encircling siege. Each of the banners measured 5 paces in length and 1 pace in breadth. The bright fabrics with their unfamiliar symbols flapped and swirled in the wind. The poles they were suspended from bent with the weight of the material, and each standard needed 4 bearers. The noise of the flags whipping in the breeze was audible from afar. This sea of flags was enough to impress the humans, the dwarves, and even the elves. For Tungdil there was, thanks to Circa, the additional knowledge that each standard represented 1,000 warriors encamped over the hills out of sight. Depicted in the arms, Tungdil noted stylized weapons, patterns like flowers, and images of animals. Still others reminded him of elaborate elf designs. No 2 were the same. He cast a final admiring glance their way, and then entered the tent where all the monarchs had foregathered. Arguments were already underway, and it was no surprise to see Rajaelin deep in conversation with Issachar and Ortgar. Prince Malan rose to his feet and rapped on the table for silence.
"As we have all seen, something very unexpected has occurred," he said in carrying tones, suppressing the last of Issachar's whispered comments. "Tungdil Goldhand, tell us what this means."
The dwarf got up.
"The Ubariu have come to secure the return of their property. Their envoy, Sundalin, explained at the previous session what vital importance the diamond has for them and for the whole of Girdlegard."
"It's a trick," exclaimed Rajaelin, radiant as the morning. "These are creatures of Teon, disguised as lambs but with the nature of beasts."
"Did we not agree we should not judge purely on appearances, princess?"
Tungdil's retort was still respectful in tone.
"Must I remind you of your own relatives? If we followed your line of argument, we would have to raise a hand against every elf in Girdlegard on the grounds that we cannot be sure there is no evil lurking in them."
He had chosen these harsh words with care, to enrage and provoke her before Estelin appeared. The more disturbed her behaviour in front of the sovereigns of Girdlegard, the better. The elf woman was not going to do him the favour of a wild retort, but her eyes flashed in his direction. She sensed the dwarf was up to something. Before Tungdil could continue, a commotion at the entrance heralded 7 of the unfamiliar Ubariu. Circa followed in their wake. The Ubariu differed in appearance from their close relatives, the orcs. Their stature was broader and more muscular. However, their faces were more finely drawn, if hardly more attractive. Sharpened tusks protruded from between their lips, and their skin was the darkest of greens. They wore skillfully fashioned iron armour, quite unlike the crude harnesses the orcs would sport. Underneath was a layer of padded dark fabric, and their feet were protected with boots. Their weapons were heavy curved swords, broad at the tip to enable a more powerful blow. They exuded a smell like lavender. Ireheart cursed under his breath and took firm hold of his crow's beak. There was a sharp intake of breath from those present. Queen Wei was heard to groan.
"Our greetings to all the rulers of Girdlegard," the Ubario spokesman bowed.
He surveyed the company with a pink-eyed gaze. The voice recalled that of an orc, but his speech, though accented, was clearly enunciated. Like Circa, of course, he was speaking a foreign language. Tungdil was astonished that the Ubario knew the common tongue the rest of them used.
"My name is Flager, and I am here to help the Ubario," and he pointed to Circa, "win back their stolen diamond."
"But I thought the orcs were the Ubario," said Issachar, thoroughly confused.
"We call each other Ubario," Circa explained. "We are both creatures of the god Ubar.
A nice family indeed, said Ortka, a flush of high emotion visible through the beard growth on his cheeks. We, said Flager civilly,